I'm really honored to be here and be able to show you what we're doing in Visual Studio 2010 on parallel computing. I will spend about 60 or 70 minutes or so talking here. Please feel free to interrupt me if you have questions, clarifying questions on what I'm saying. And then after that, there'll be some time for concentrated questions and answers until about 10:30, I believe, is where we are ending. So, parallel computing. The parallel computing platform team is part of the developer division at Microsoft, and developer division is responsible for two primary products, Visual Studio and .NET. Just within a couple of months from now, we will be releasing the commercial version of Visual Studio 2010. It's been available in a couple of beta versions, and it's right now in release candidate stage. And we're doing some really exciting stuff for parallel computing in both .NET 4, which is coming out at the same time, and Visual Studio 2010. And here's what I'm going to be talking about. I'm going to talk first a little bit, and for those of you who don't know already, which I suspect that many of you do, why parallelism is suddenly high on the agenda for Microsoft and for the software industry as a whole. I'll talk about what we're doing on the managed side, in other words, the .NET side of the technology stack or the platforms. And I'll also talk about what we're doing for C++, the native platform. And I'll spend a bit of time on tools, because we're doing some what I think is really exciting work there too. The fundamental issue is that while Moore's law, which says that we will increase transistor density on integrated circuits, we will double the density about every 24 months or 18 to 24 months. While that law is still seemingly in effect, we've also been seeing over the last several decades a doubling of clock speed every 18 to 24 months. And that we're not seeing anymore. So what are we using the increased transistor density for when we're not making the chips any more, the architecture a whole lot more complicated? We're not speeding things up a lot. We build bigger caches. So that's one thing that we're doing, or not we as in Microsoft, but we as an industry. The other thing is that we're adding more processor units to the chips. And that's really the only way that we're going to be able to continue to make performance increases is if our software starts taking advantage of the additional processing cores. Here's some quotes. I'm not going to read them verbatim for you, but some quotes that really several years ago already pointed to the need to really change how we do software in order to continue to take advantage of hardware advancements. And this is a picture of a not too expensive server machine with 128 cores. And in Windows 7 and Windows Server 2008 R2, we're able to handle more than 64. There was a limit in previous versions of Windows that limited us to 64 processors. And we've broken through that boundary with Windows 7, and we can now do this many and many more too. So this is the dilemma then. There's no more free lunch that we've been able to ride the wave of I write software for the processors that are available 2 years from now. And when my software comes out and then the hardware improves, customers will immediately realize a benefit from upgrading to new hardware because the software runs twice as fast or much, much better in general. That's not going to be happening unless we continue to, unless we find other ways of accomplishing the same thing. The issue, though, is that most companies lack parallel expertise. It's something that we haven't had to deal with in the past, and now we find ourselves forced to. Also that the vendors, companies like Microsoft, haven't had to deal with this because their need hasn't been there before. And the tools that are available today are just not all that mature. We're hoping to take a first step towards changing this with Visual Studio 2010, but we have quite a bit of distance to go yet. So in 2010, what we're focusing on are three major areas of adding value. One is on the developer productivity side. Developer productivity is what developer division sells. That's our overall value in the first place. So it shouldn't be surprising that this is the top value proposition for our work in Visual Studio 2010 and .NET 4. But we're also, even though productivity is what we really sell, we still can't give up on things like performance. That's really important. If you're productive but your code doesn't run fast, then you're not really getting all the value you can. So there's a lot of work we've done on execution efficiency, and we'll talk about that quite a bit, actually. Platform light-up. Light-up is a Microsoft term for when we make new advancements, when we innovate in the platform, or when hardware vendors innovate in their technology, and you buy a new system, you upgrade your version of Windows, or you're just getting the new stuff, your software, without change, lights up. It performs better. It does something it didn't do, or just gives you a better experience overall. That's what we call light up. So we're trying to take advantage of, we're trying to provide it so that when you're upgrading from XP to Windows 7 or from Vista to Windows 7, you're getting a better experience in your parallel applications without actually changing your code. And I'll talk a little bit, not much about that, but I'll talk a little bit about that also. Execution efficiency. I'll show you all about the productivity, but I want to talk a little bit about the minimizing the overhead of parallelism, because this is where the execution efficiency comes in. When you have parallel work or work, and you need to parallelize it, in other words, use many execution units to run it, you need to divide it. Right? That's kind of a given. But the issue is that all work, including the sequential work, has some overhead to it. You need to create a thread. You need to start the main program. You need to load things into memory. You need to, whatever it is that you do, there's always overhead associated with getting your user code, which is the only thing that really matters, it's the only thing that actually does anything, to run. So all this blue stuff is bad. And now if we divide it, the overhead is kind of, it's a fixed cost typically. Right? So the overhead is just as big here as here, but we have it four times. And the ratio of real work, your code, to overhead has just gone down. And that's bad. You want a high ratio of work to overhead. And when you then see that 128 cores, or even 16 cores, or 24 cores, or 32 cores, the overhead at some point, unless you do something about the overhead is going to be all you have, right? You're going to get very, very little time to your own work. And at this point, not only is parallelization futile, it is just, you know, running your program at all seems kind of not very useful, right? So this is a barrier to adoption of parallel technologies. And so this is what we want to do, and this is what we try to do in Visual Studio 2010, right? We actually are working very, very hard to reduce overhead. And as it turns out, it is something incredibly hard. And one of the reasons why developer productivity is lost in parallelization is because you have to spend so much time not on your code, not on breaking down your algorithm to a parallel form, but on reducing the overhead. And since it doesn't actually contribute to the logic of your code, it's not really economically interesting for, you know, non-Microsoft developers to work on. It's something that Microsoft should be, as a tools vendor, as a platform vendor, sort of be doing the heavy lifting so that you can focus on your business value. All right. So I'll go into why it's hard also in just a second. Here's what we're doing in Visual Studio 2010 and .NET 4. A lot of this is is platform stuff. So on the managed side, .NET, well, let me first say that underneath all of this is the operating system, obviously, Windows. And in Windows 7, we're adding something called user mode schedulable threads. And this is one of those light up features that when moving from Vista or XP to Windows 7, you'll suddenly be starting to get access to UMS threads. And they're threads that have lower overhead for context switching. They have better integration with I/O and so on and so forth from a user mode perspective than regular threads do. Some of it is fairly marginal, and there are some lots of circumstances where it really you won't see the difference. Other circumstances, there will be a significant difference from using UMS threads. But they'll just light up on it when you're using Windows 7. And so we have, and I'll just sort of walk from the bottom up here. We have on the managed side, we have the managed thread pool, which we have added features to make it better from an overhead perspective and from matching parallel algorithms. On the native side, we've added this thing we call the concurrency runtime or concert, which has two big blocks to it, two big pieces to it. One is the resource manager, which is responsible for making sure that we fairly allocate resources to different parallel libraries. One risk that you're always facing when you're buying a library from somebody is that that library believes that it's the only thing on the machine, that it's not competing for resources with other vendors, with other libraries. And so when you're, for example, if you run something on OpenMP, which is a parallel library that both Intel and Microsoft and others are shipping, and maybe you're running on something like R libraries or Intel's thread building blocks and things like that, and you may not even be aware that you're doing that because you actually bought a library that's a little bit higher up in the stack, they all think they own the machine. OpenMP will for sure think that it has the entire machine at its disposal. And typically TBB and even our libraries will say, oh, I have 8 processors, I'll split the work 8 ways. Well, now you have 3 libraries perhaps, or 2 at least, that are making that same calculation and not communicating with each other about the fact that they're actually running at the same time. Well, we're going to get oversubscription. We're going to get lots of preemption because we have too many worker threads running. The resource manager is there to solve that problem. And we feel that we're in a unique position to provide that sort of lowest common denominator piece that has libraries communicating with each other about their resource needs. Above that, we built a task scheduler. And I'll talk about tasks in a minute. But it's really we're trying to advocate a moving away from scheduling threads to scheduling tasks. And tasks are components of an algorithm. Threads are something much more physical and less logical, if you will. We want you to focus on your algorithm, not how things are going to be scheduled, where they're going to be running, at what priority, and things like that, that you have to do with threads. Above the scheduling layers, which are these two down here, we have the libraries. And this is where we have some algorithmic APIs. On the managed side, we have two primary components, the task parallel library, which is a fairly low-level API that gives you these tasks that you can schedule. As tasks are intended to be short-lived units of computation. It also provides you with some fairly common primitives like a parallel for, parallel for each, a parallel recursive algorithmic subdivision or decomposition primitive, and support for cancellation and so on and so forth. Parallel link is a really exciting technology that we built to parallelize link to objects and link to XML without almost, and I emphasize almost, without almost any work on your part. That's just a little thing you have to write, and suddenly the whole thing is parallel. Now, not all queries will be good candidates for parallelization, but those that are will require extremely little work on your part. Another really exciting development in Visual Studio 2010 is that we're shipping a new managed language, F#, which is belongs to the ML family of functional languages. And it's well worth taking a look at. It has a lot of interesting features that makes it a good candidate to use for writing parallel programs. Functional programs, or the functional programming style, is one that is very amenable to parallelization, just based on how functional programs work. On the native side, we have these two libraries that we call Parallel Pattern Library. It's a lot like the Task Parallel Library in that it provides the task concept, it provides support for cancellation and exception propagation among tasks. It has the parallel for, parallel for each, parallel and invoke, which is the recursive thing. We're also doing something that we're not doing on the managed side. We're providing this library we call the Async Agents Library. And it's a C++ template-based library to support an evolution of the thread model, where we have these units called agents, which are a little bit intended to be a little bit more long-running than tasks, and do their synchronization via message passing. And we'll look at an example of that later. And on both the managed and the native side, we're shipping these concurrent data structures that help you do thread-safe dictionaries and queues and vectors and so on and so forth. On the tool side, there are two major features that we're adding. One is this parallel debugger, these parallel debugger windows, and there's two of them, and we'll talk about them a little bit. And then we're doing a concurrency analysis profiler that is I'm really, really very excited about, and we'll take a look at that also later. So first, let me go into the managed side of the platform. As I said earlier, we had these three components to that, in addition to making some changes to the thread pool underlying all of this. So tasks. Tasks actually exist already in the .NET APIs, and they're called user work items. And the thread pool, the .NET 3.5 thread pool, has this queue user work item feature that allows you and has allowed you to do task-based computing for quite a while. And they're great for fire and forget, because one thing about the queue user work item API is that you give it a delegate, and that's it. After that, it's going to execute at some point in the future. And if you want any sort of synchronization with it, like wait for it to complete or try to cancel it, or you know, saying, after this worker item completes, then I want to do this other work. I want to queue up this other worker item, like we call that continuation. Or compose worker items. And so like, I want this and this to complete, and then when they're done, I want to do this with the result of both of them. All those kinds of things are completely up to your own to do, right, with some ad hoc methodology. So we wanted to cut out that from the list of things you need to do in order to write parallel algorithms. And so that's the sort of the basic idea behind the task parallel library. But it needed some changes to the thread pool in order to be efficient. And let me explain, because this, I think this is kind of an interesting thing to understand about the thread pool and about the new thread pool. The old thread pool has a global work item queue. So when you call queue user work item, things are scheduled on this FIFO queue, first in, first out, right? And then these worker threads exist, and there's n, and n is determined by the runtime based on load and based on number of processors existing and so on and so forth. It's not necessarily a one-to-one correlation between processors and worker threads. But we have n worker threads, and they start picking up items like this. And when more user work item or more tasks result from the work that has already been scheduled, it goes on this FIFO queue. And when work completes, then it's being picked up again in first in, first out order. And of course, things outside the thread pool can also be generating more work items as it goes. And why is this bad? Well, there's a single global queue. And when you have, in a parallel system, when you have anything that you can say global in front of, you typically should be seeing a red flag that says, OK, this must be bad. Right? And the reason is that all these worker threads have to compete to take locks on the global queue. And even if it's a lock-free implementation, there's still some possibility of stalling while you're waiting to take things out. So we want to avoid that global queue, but how? Right? What's really great about global queues is that they promote fairness. They promote the idea that things are serviced in the order that they are produced. Okay? And this is generally seen as a good thing because otherwise you can wind up with starvation and really bad aspects, you know, really bad consequences of scheduling. However, when you're doing things like, if you think about this, if you're doing a parallel for, and the parallel for is supposed to, for example, compute the sum of something, then you don't care about fairness at all, because the iterations all have to finish before you're done. So from the algorithm's perspective, it doesn't matter one bit if the iterations of the for loop are scheduled in the order that they were created. It really, really, really doesn't matter. And so for algorithms that don't care about fairness, which is most parallel algorithms, in fact, what we do is we add these things called work-stealing queues. And they're local to each worker thread. And what we wind up with is a combination of this FIFO queue into which these tasks are scheduled from the outside the thread pool. And the difference is that when the tasks have, as a side effect, generate more work, they put them on their local queues, like this. And when work finishes, or actually also when work pauses, what happens is that we pick them up like this, and not in FIFO order, in the reverse order, so last in, first out. And this is good. First of all, we can do this because we don't care about fairness, right? We know we're not going to starve here. So we don't care about fairness in this particular situation. But this is also good because this promotes cache locality, because the task that was the most recently created is the one that, heuristically speaking, is the most likely to have shared working set with the task that created it, right? So its data is most likely to be warm in the cache. So taking the last one first is a good idea in this particular instance. So we do that. Now, here's a situation that creates a little bit of a conundrum for us, which is that that worker thread over here, it finished, and it doesn't find any work in its own local work-stealing queue. It doesn't find any work in the global queue. So what is it supposed to do? It's idle. It's now without work. Well, what it does is it goes and steals work from another processor. And this is why it's called work-stealing. It's because it actually takes from the other end of the queue, so we kind of have a combined stack slash queue here, it takes them in FIFO order from the other local queue and picks them up. Why does it do that? Well, it does that because the thing that is at the front of the queue, or on the top of the queue, is the one that is least likely, based on what I said earlier, to have the good cache effects of being picked up by the same worker thread. So that's the best candidate for moving over to another cache. All right? And what we can also do, and this is where the reduced overhead comes in, pushing and popping onto these things, as it turns out, is an extremely efficient operation. It's completely lock-free, and it doesn't even require any serious barriers or anything like that. Whereas taking from the top of the queue, actually, is fairly expensive. So what we're doing is we're amortizing the cost of this queue to the stealing end entirely, and have a very, very low overhead on the pushing and popping side. And what that means is that when we have idle workers, we're willing to pay the cost of picking up from that end and take the contention in that queue, but only when we have idle tasks. So then it's worth it, is the idea here. Okay. So what are we using this for then? Well, in Task Parallel Library, you can create your own tasks, just like you can do with user work items. And you can build your own algorithms from that. But we also support three very important use cases for this type of parallelism. And there's a huge number of parallel algorithms that fit into either one of these three. The first one is a loop over an integer range, such as you would be indexing into an array or a vector of some sort. Matrix multiplication is an example of when you would do this. The second one is iteration over a collection of objects. And the third one is just a sequence of statements that happen to be independent of each other for their internals, but they all need to happen before you can move on to the next statement. So when we know, and it's still your task to know that these things can be parallelized. The task parallel library makes it really easy for you to take this form and turn it into this form. Okay? So this is a parallel for, this is a parallel for each, and we call this parallel.invoke. What it does is it takes every lambda that you pass in here, so see how easy the transformation is. Every lambda, it runs in parallel, but it will not move on past the invoke, past the semicolon there, if you will, until all of them are done. This is useful for recursive algorithms, primarily, that are that can be parallelized. For example, a really simple example of that is that the sort part, the sort stage of quicksort can be trivially parallelized. It can be done recursively through this mechanism. Merge sort is even better when it comes to parallelization. So what we do then is we treat these as synchronous things. In other words, at the semicolon, we wait. And that also gives us an opportunity to propagate exceptions and provide cancellation support. And you're automatically getting the waiting that you had to, through ad hoc methods, do yourself if you were doing queue user work item. That just follows automatically from this pattern. Now, if you have more unstructured types of algorithms where you don't want fork join, you just want a fork and then some irregular join later, then you can always do that with the task API that this all builds on. So there are lots of dials and knobs on this. We have support for cancellation. I said that we have. You can custom partition these things so that it's not just one step at a time. You can define that the degrees of parallelism should be less than the number of processors on the machine, etc., etc. I'm not going to go through all of that. And this also works really nice with a new profiling support that I'm going to show you. All right, we're getting close to the point where I'm going to show you some code. And what we have here is a link query. I hope that most of you are familiar with link. We've been shipping it for a few years, and it's really an exciting way of dealing with analytics of object graphs. So here, we're taking a small database of newborn names arranged by year and by state, as it is also. And what we're doing is we're comparing from the collection of baby name for babies, baby records, we're comparing the name against some form entry that we had for name and state, and then, of course, for a given year range. And we order that by the year, and what we wind up with is something that can be histogrammed to establish a histogram of what was popular names over the decades. All right, so the parallel version of this looks like that. I hope you can see the contrast is kind of bad here, but I just had to add S parallel after the collection object. Okay? So it's hard to imagine it getting any easier than that, and I wish all parallelism was this easy, but when it is this easy, it's kind of nice to have it work like that. So I actually have that code running. Here's a program that just grabs these queries for use elsewhere in the application. This is a WinForms. Actually, I guess it's the WPF application. Here's the sequential query and the parallel query, and I have it up and running here. If I press this link button, it's going to run the sequential query. If I press the parallel link button, it's going to run the parallel query. And what I'm looking for here is the name Stephen in the state of New Hampshire. And I believe that this is a range from 1960 through 1990 or something like that. And we can see how it kind of went up and down. There's no particular trend to this name. And if I run it in parallel link, I'll see that I get a 3.4 speed up on this 4-core machine. And I did all I did was put that as parallel on. Now, there are lots and lots of queries that are easy to parallelize. And there are some that aren't. Depends on the data set and depends on how easily partitioned it is. Now, PLINK does support custom partitioning. So if you know something that the system can't just sort of guess at for partitioning, then you can provide a custom partitioner that helps the system along. That's all, often sort of the core issue with parallelization is the data set. Can it be partitioned or not? And this is what database query optimization sort of spends so much of its time doing. Let's go back to the presentation. All right. In terms of collection and other primitives that we are adding, these are things that, you know, in many ways aren't dependent on the TPL libraries or anything like that. They can be used with threads just as well as with tasks. But we're adding some highly scalable collections. Some of them implement this new API or a new interface, I should say, called iProducer Consumer Collection. We have a queue, a stack, and a bag. We're also adding a concurrent dictionary. And they all support, you know, enumeration and so on and so forth in a thread-safe way. For synchronization, more basic synchronization, like facing your application, we have barriers. We have a collection that you can use on top of these others to do blocking producer-consumer exchanges. We have a countdown event that says, you know, count down to 10 and when, from N, right? And when it reaches 0, then signal the event. Can be useful. Partitioning, I talked about this earlier. You can write your own custom partitioners that can be extremely useful to parallelize queries and such. Exception handling, so when you have a parallel 4, for example, and you have exceptions raised in multiple of your iterations, we do the right thing in terms of aggregating those exceptions and propagating them as one exception in this new thing called aggregate exception. We have support for lazy initialization, thread local storage. We have some new locks. Spinning is horrible on a single core machine and extremely useful on a parallel machine because sometimes, you know, locks that are held for very short amounts periods of time, you're better off when you get to a lock and you find that it's already taken, sometimes you're better off just spinning around in a while loop until it's given up because if you go into the kernel and actually wait for it to be signaled, then you're going to be allowing the kernel to switch something else and the cache will be ruined and so on and so forth. So sometimes you want to spin for a little while until in case the lock is one that is held for a short time, and then you can be much more efficient than with a traditional lock, like a Win32 critical section or something like that. So we have a spin lock, we have a spinning wait, it's the same thing. We have support for cancellation also. All right. So since this is an overview talk, I'll now move on to the native side without going further into the managed stuff. The value propositions, again, we come back to productivity, making it easier to express concurrency. We have tasks, we have parallel loops. We have support for pipelining with this agents library that I'll talk about. And you can build your own parallel patterns. And I'm saying this, you know, just like in managed code, right, we have the ability to build on the low-level task primitives. But on the C++ side, almost everything we're doing in these libraries is template-based, which means that, you know, the source code is there. So it's fairly easy to take, like, a parallel 4. If you don't like how we implemented parallel 4, you can look at how we did it and tweak it, right? Or, you know, make your own version because the template code is there. You can look at it. You can tweak it. You can change it. And that's something that we, in fact, we're not doing anything to keep you from that if that's what you feel that you need to do. It's not necessarily easy, but it's something that can be done. And we give you, and you know, obviously all the source code has to be there because it's all template-based. All right, so the runtime is composable, it's scalable. Composition, again, was this thing. You're running a vendor A library, and you're running a vendor B library, and you're running a Microsoft library. They all compose in the sense that they can be used together efficiently. All right? Managing shared state, we have some concurrent containers, a much smaller set than on the managed side. We have an alternative to synchronization and data exchange with the agents library, which I will describe in a second. And again, we work really well with the new parallel development tools work that's coming in Visual Studio 2010. The parallel pattern library concepts, again, we have this concept of a task. It's a computation that may be run asynchronously. In other words, it may be run without waiting for it, but you can explicitly wait for it also. A task group is a collection of tasks that form one logical computation. So, for example, what is produced by a parallel 4 and how a parallel 4 is implemented is in terms of a task group. We don't have this as directly exposed on the manage side, I believe, at least not in the same way. But in the native API, it's very explicitly there in the API, and you're expected to sort of depend on it. And then we have, and these APIs all use the standard template library style of design. We have a few algorithms, and they also support cancellation, composition, and exception propagation is a little bit trickier in C++ than it is in managed code, because you don't have a common base class that you can guarantee that all exceptions will derive from. So exception propagation, and particularly exception aggregation, is a lot trickier there. But so we don't actually aggregate them. We take the first one in a for loop, for example. If you have exceptions being raised from multiple iterations of the parallel 4, we take the first one, and that's the one that's propagated. It's a little bit different than on the managed side. These are the primary APIs that we're offering. We have a task handle. That's actually the task. We have task groups. We have structured task groups, which is just an optimization for situations where the task group can be allocated on the stack instead of on the heap. In other words, the situations where it's a completely regular fork join within the body of a function. It is much faster because of the we can avoid the heap allocation. Parallel 4, parallel 4 each, parallel invoke, exactly the same semantics with the exception of exception propagation that we have in managed code. And we then have a different set of synchronization primitives. We don't have a barrier, for example. We have a reader-writer lock. We have moved the Win32 critical section, which is commonly used for synchronizing in native code. We've moved that into C++ and created, it's now a class. And we did that because we wanted it to be runtime aware and particularly UMS aware. We have an event that is also runtime aware, UMS aware. We have only a concurrent queue and a concurrent vector. And these are two classes where we share the implementation of with Intel. So in Intel's threading building blocks, they have the same implementation of concurrent queue and concurrent vector, so that we didn't want to diverge in implementation between those two. We have this thing called combinable, which is used for reductions, which is when you take a vector or some vector style collection and you compute a scalar from it, for example, a sum or an average or a min-max and things like that. And that can be incredibly inefficient if you don't know what you're doing, and it's I'll show that later on also. It's easy even for those who are experienced to make very, very naive mistakes. So combinable avoids all that. It's very easy to use, and it's extremely efficient also. Asynchronous agents. An agent, unlike a task, an agent which is supposed to be a fairly fine-grained component running for a few thousand or a few million cycles, agents are kind of expected to be more like threads. Not the thread pool threads that you schedule work item on, but the threads that you create with create thread and use for long-running computations, maybe doing a lot of I/O and so on and so forth. Agents are supposed to give us sort of a migration path from threads to something more, something less ad hoc, if you will. They are doing their synchronization and data exchange through message passing. and they're composed using these two concepts called sources and targets. And sources and targets, the things that implement those two interfaces, that implement those two interfaces or abstract base classes, we call message blocks. And those are the ones that propagate data in the system. And then we have a send and receive primitive, which are utility functions for message passing. So the idea of message passing is that you don't synchronize and then exchange data. You exchange data, and you achieve synchronization through the exchange of data. So you just send a message. Agent A wants to communicate with agent 2, or it wants to just do a barrier. It wants to, both of them wants to reach a certain place in the program and then move on. Whatever it is that they need to do to synchronize, they send a message, which is a block of data or something like that, right? So to build an agent, and again, what an agent provides is a model for lifetime management and state management that can be privatized. And the migration path I talked about also. It's very simple to build an agent. You derive your class from the base class agent in the concurrency namespace. You expose only sources and targets from the agent. In other words, no methods except the constructor. No methods. Methods would violate the idea that you do all your data exchange through message passing. So sources and targets, and the only thing you use them for is sending to. And then you connect up your targets to internal data structures in the start routine or the constructor. All right, so the message blocks that are built in, and again, this is all template stuff, so if you want a bounded buffer or you want something else here, priority queue, whatever it may be, you can build those and follow our style of implementation by looking at the template code. We have three buffers. The first one is an unbounded buffer. It's kind of a fundamental component in any asynchronous system. We have an override buffer, which is really just a variable, if you think of it. It's just a variable that implements isource and itarget. So what it does is it has room for exactly one item. And as you send things to it, it overwrites whatever is there already. It can also be empty. But if it's not, if it's full, you sending to it just overwrites what's there. If you read from it, in other words, you receive a value from it, you get the value that's stored there. You block if there's nothing in there, but you get the value that's stored there, and it stays in there. So you get a copy of it. Single assignment is a lot like an override buffer, except you can only define its value once. You can only write to it once. So it's a generalization of the const concept, if you will. Pipelining. We have two blocks that are used to invoke code inside from within a message block. One is a transformer. It takes data of one type and produces data of the other type. So it's really a functional type of block. And an unbounded buffer is just a trivial special case of the transformer. And then we have a call node, which takes data of a type and produces absolutely nothing. So anything it does will have to be done through side effects. And those are typically used then at the very end of a pipeline or a network. We need some compositional structures. We have something called choice, which you can see as an OR. And we have a join, which you can see as an AND. So choice will take a number of sources and combine them into a single source that gets the data from the first thing that produces data. Join will wait for data from all its sources and then produce a vector or a tuple of the values that it got from the various input sources. Send and receive, again, those are just functions that are there as convenience routines. And I'm giving you an example here of using agents to achieve parallelism in a image processing application. So what we have is an application that will it will create a cartoon-like effect of an image. So you have a photograph or you have a video, and a video is really just a set of images following each other in an ordered sequence. But if you have an image and you want to make it look like it was drawn, you have to do a couple of things. You have to make the color gradients much more simple. So it's just either a single color or maybe a couple instead of a full gradient. And the other thing you need to do is that the edges need to be drawn in black ink, because that's what you do when you draw cartoons, right? So what we do then is we have this thing over here called the video reader. It's an agent. It reads from file, and it produces either a single image or multiple images and puts it into this pipeline. Now, we actually have multiple pipelines of color simplification, which is the first stage of image processing here. And the reason is that color simplification is an algorithm that can be blocked. In other words, you can divide up the picture into smaller blocks and process the blocks individually. Okay? You don't have to have information across blocks to be able to do that process. So that's a source of parallelism in our processing. Another source of parallelism is the fact that if we have a video and not an image, and I'm going to just demonstrate an image here, but if we have video, then the first frame can move deeper into the pipeline, while earlier stages in the pipeline process later frames. Right? So that's another source of parallelism. A third source of parallelism is that each individual block, the actual filter process that does the color simplification, can be parallelized with a parallel loop. Parallel 4. All right. So we have three sort of dimensions, if you will, of parallelism being introduced in this system, which hopefully should be very efficient. Then we have a join. That's the green thing. That's a pre-built block, no user logic there. It just waits for all the blocks of a particular frame or image to be done, merges them back together, and gives them to edge detection, which is one of those algorithms that do require that you have more global information about the picture in order to perform it, at least as I understand it. I'm not an image processing guy, but that's what I understand. So let me show this running. And in the interest of time here, I'm going to just do an image instead of a video, because this is... after all, just a four-core machine. And I'm going to do it in serial first. I'm going to pick an image. Here, this tulips thing. It's a picture of a field of tulips. Well, let's see what happens here. It's actually, my experience, a great candidate for this processing. And the more, we're just going to do three stages of color simplification. I understand that if you do more, you get an even stronger effect. In this case, we don't actually display it for some reason. Let's try it again. There we go. Okay, so we can see here that we actually have fewer gradients. It's not quite gradient-free, but we see black lines being outlined here, just as if you had drawn it first and then filled in with color. All right, that took about 5.3 seconds. That's the serial time here. Now, I have various parallel options. The one that's the fastest is this multiple pipeline that I actually drew a picture of before, right? Where I have multiple pipelines, I'm blocking the image, let's see what that does. Okay, 1.4 seconds, so I get a 3.8x speed up, which is almost linear because I have a four-core machine here, right? So the combination of overlapping I/O with computation, because I have the agent, the reader agent, which reads data from disk, I have the edge detection, which actually also is a writer. It produces this image, not in a file, but on the GUI. And that involves some I/O. I am doing a three-stage pipeline. I'm blocking the image, dividing it up into blocks. There's a combination of I/O, concurrency, and parallel decomposition here at work that gives me an almost linear speed up. And this actually on video, where you have even more opportunity to do take advantage of the stages, we can scale this up to 48 processors at least, and see a very near linear speed up. So it's an algorithm that is very good for parallelization. You may notice that we actually do, this is interesting for video, the edge detection will have a feedback loop to the video reader saying, don't get ahead of yourself. We're doing throttling here. And throttling is important because if you don't throttle, you can have a lot of work being built up over here. And what will happen is that the early stage will starve the later stages. So all the work will be going on here. We won't see any work going on here because there's only so many threads that can be scheduled. And that's really bad. So we need to do throttling. It's just a common scenario. All right, let me get to the tools. We're doing there are two things that we think is important for you when you're writing your parallel application, and you've taken advantage of the new APIs, or maybe you already have an application you wrote with the Threads API, and it's not performing the way you had hoped it would. Right? You're certainly not seeing linear scale-up, and maybe you weren't even expecting linear scale-up, but you were certainly expecting something better than what you're seeing. Right? And there could be two things. So that's sort of what you would use the profiler for. And also, you could be introducing bugs that are hard to detect because you now have, you know, 50 moving units all at once instead of one. And you need to maybe make sense a little bit of that, of all those units that are computing all at once. And that's what we would say you'd use the debugger for. So let's talk about what we have there. We have two new debugger tool windows. We have one that is giving you, instead of a threads view of the things that are executing, we give you a task-centric view. So if you've been using, you know, we still have a thread-centric view. We're not taking that out. But if you are taking advantage of TPL for managed code or the PPL or agents libraries for C++, you may want to see your information presented in terms of tasks instead of in terms of threads. Because if that's what you're doing, the thread's purpose is only to serve as workers. They don't really have any logical connection to your code. All right? So you want to see it presented in something that makes more sense in terms of the logical structure of your code, right? Well, that's what the tasks window is for. Now, an interesting thing to note when you are dividing an algorithm. Let's say you have a for loop that you parallelized with a parallel.for. Uh-oh, I did not mean to do that. If you took a for loop and parallelized it. Now, there's a sort of a logical relationship between the thing that called the parallel for and the children that are executing the iterations, right? You kind of want to think of that as the parent frame on the call stack. But the reality is that that child work item or task will be executed on some thread pool thread, and the first user frame in its call stack will be the body of the for loop. So you will lose all context if you're looking at a threads window, right? If you're looking at the call stack, regular call stack, you will lose all context of where that work was created, and thus how you got there in the first place. You will not be able to walk up the stack and see, oh, I was calling this from this and da-da-da-da, right? You will not be able to see that. So in the parallel stacks window, we recreate that information and make it look more like you would expect it. And not only do you get a stack, but you'll get a tree, because what you actually have when you're forking is a tree of activation frames, or stack frames. So the task window has a little bit more information than the thread window. And you can figure things out like, you know, my task is waiting and it's deadlocked. It was never going to stop waiting. You get status like, oh, this task is right now running, or it was at least until you hit the breakpoint. Some task is waiting for a synchronization event, maybe a barrier, maybe an event or something like that. We can also know that tasks have been scheduled, but they're not been given a processor yet. And we can see there's this field called the parent field, which establishes a relationship between this task 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, these tasks, and 2, which is the parent. That's apparently the one that created them. So maybe this is a for loop, and 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10 are iterations of the for loop. They haven't been started yet, but the parent is still running, and it's not at the point where it's going to be waiting, but they're there, right? And there's other information, too. And of course, you can move from this window to the stack window very easily and to the source code and so on and so forth. The window supports both TPL and PPL, so both managed and native tasks. The native tasks don't have this parent-child relationship, but the managed do. And you know, the window is supposed to help answer a bunch of questions that are task-oriented instead of thread-oriented. Now, the parallel stacks window looks a little bit different from the call stack window. And that's because you're really dealing with a tree. So if we look at this picture, what we have at the bottom here is we have four tasks where the bottom of the stack, the call stack, is s.a, s.b, s.c here. And then it forks out. So we have one of its tasks looks like this, one task looks like this, and two tasks look like this first, and then like this, right? So we have a tree. It's called a cactus stack in sort of parallel, in the parallel world, if you will, where it kind of, if you're looking at it from the bottom, it looks like there's things going up like this and things forking out like this randomly, and it kind of looks like a cactus in the desert. Now, this window can be used for tasks. That's where you will see a lot of branching like this, but it can also be used for thread-based applications. It's useful, and particularly when you have the combination of the two, that can be very illuminating to have. The parallel profiler is the other tool. So you parallelize your application, you run it in debug mode. When I put this down, it starts pressing buttons for me, apparently. So I run it in debug mode, and I don't expect much performance because, after all, it's in debug mode, so we all know how that is, right? And then I change to release mode, and it's still just as badly as it did in debug mode. And what is going on? Well, to answer that question, you can use the profiler, but a regular profiler isn't all that helpful in answering those questions because it's looking for the wrong thing. A regular profiler would look for hotspots in your serial code and tell you, yeah, this loop is not very efficient, or you're doing way too many function calls here and object allocations there, all those types of things. But it doesn't tell you about synchronization issues. It doesn't tell you much about this thing is blocking on this thing, and so on and so forth. And it doesn't tell you how efficiently you're using the various cores that you have over time, like this. So what we added is a concurrent profiler that helps answer some of those questions. And it has three main views. The first view is the CPU utilization. This is the place to start looking. Because what you see here is you see green, which is your user code, your logic, the one that actually provides some business value, running. You see gray, which means nothing is running. You see yellow, which is other processors, like who knows if it's a virus checker or Outlook or whatever it may be, right? It's running in the background, doing work every now and then. Red here is the kernel getting in, and you don't often see a lot of striped red, but, well, maybe you do if you're doing a lot of kernel work, but typically that doesn't show up all that much, right? But the green stuff is good. That's what we want to see as much as possible. Okay. Now, the second view is, okay, let's figure out we're diving into information here a little bit, but into details. What are all our threads or our worker threads doing? So we have this thread window where we have these swim lanes. Each swim lane is for one worker thread. And worker threads are approximately, equal to processors, right? But not quite. We have another window to do that. And green is good. Red is synchronization. Red is you're waiting for something. Blue is memory management, typically page faults. And yellow is yellow, right? It's other processes, something else that you were preempted. You were swapped out to somebody else that wanted that processor that you were running on. There's other colors here. You're sleeping, doing I/O. We don't have real good examples of that in this particular diagram. And the third view is this cores view that says, actually, here are the four cores that you have on your machine. How are they being used? And what we color code here are the worker threads. And this view is we're using to look for something called thread migration. And thread migration is your enemy when you're writing an application, a parallel application, based on worker threads as sort of the underlying scheduling mechanism. What thread migration means is that a worker thread, which you wanted to have as a logically connected to a processor so that you can manage cache locality and so on and so forth, is hopping around from core to core. So what you want to see, a particular color follow one single swim lane. That's efficient. A color that jumps up and down, up and down, up and up and up and up, is very inefficient. And if you have a little bit of hopping around like you have here, where the purple, for example, the purple color is here, mostly in this lane, but a little bit up there. The green is mostly up here, but a little bit down there, and even a little bit down here. You have slight inefficiency, but it's not horribly bad. But you know, there are much worse patterns than this you can find. Okay, I'm going to show a little bit of an example in this. And the actual code example is a very, as parallel algorithms go, it's really simple. It's a reduction. It's a summing of elements in a vector. And in fact, this is an integer vector with 20 million elements in it. And it takes, for integers, because addition is so cheap, it takes about 20 million to even make it remotely parallelizable, you know, to actually see any parallel effects. Okay, so I'm going to start with a really naive implementation, which on purpose has problems. We create an accumulator variable called sum. That's where we're going to keep the overall sum. And then we're going to do a parallel for, and we're thinking ahead. So we're saying, if I parallelize this for every item, I'm going to have 20 million work items. That might be a little bit too much. Even with the low overhead of work stealing and of concert, it might just be too much. And particularly since I know I only have 4 cores, 20 million might be overdoing it. So I'm really clever here, I think, and I'm saying I'm going to chunk up the loop or the vector in 4 chunks, right? And I'm going to parallelize over those 4 chunks. And then individually, within each chunk, I'm going to do a serial summation, okay? So I'm being clever, I think, at least. Now, however, this accumulator variable sum is a shared. It's going to be shared between all those chunks. So I need to protect it. Okay, so I need a critical section. Create a critical section. I start my parallel for, and within the body of the parallel for, I take the critical section and I give it up, right? Because I need to protect my sum. Otherwise, I would have race conditions galore here, and who knows what result I would actually come up with. All right. So let's take a look at what that looks like in the profiler. Well, first of all, it looks like this on the cores view. Green at the one core level with occasional very, very brief spikes. And they're probably not from the computation itself, actually. Very, very brief spikes of green above there. But they're, you know, they're completely insignificant. Lots of yellow because we're saying, well, we just want one. So, you know, whatever else needs to run can go ahead and just do that, right? The red, I think, is towards the end here. We're getting out of that loop and getting some, doing some I/O, but I'm not actually sure what the red is. Okay. Now, here is where this thing is really, really useful. And I want to show you what we have on MSDN. We have this gallery of patterns to look for. And there's one thing that the human brain is much, much more efficient than computers are. Well, there's several things, but one thing in particular that's of relevance here is looking for visual patterns and processing them very, very quickly and very, very accurately, actually. And so this is something that we're leveraging in the concurrent profiler and these views, is that particular principle or that particular fact. So what we have then is we have a gallery of these common patterns for poorly behaved applications that you can match what you're seeing against. And right now it's not a very huge gallery by any means, but it does have a few patterns. And it actually turns out that the one that we're seeing is this first one. We're seeing lots of red, and we see green that is never, you know, we never see any green at the same time. It's always, you know, staged like that, right? And this is typical for lock contention. And if we go down, we'll see this. Ah, it's exactly what we saw, right? Green, some gray, some yellow. This is exactly what we saw. So we're probably dealing with lock contention. That's what we can conclude. And yes, we are. I saw some knowing laughs in the audience while I was doing this. So this is really, really bad. Because, in fact, what we're doing is we're saying, I want to run necessarily, but I want to take three or four threads to do so. Right? So I just added a lot of overhead, but I'm not actually adding any opportunity for parallelism because all the work is done within a single critical section that is completely serializing my code. All right. So, okay, I'm not going to version 3 just yet. Let me enable this version. So now what I'm doing is I'm being even more clever, and I'm saying, I really need an accumulator variable per chunk, so I'm going to, in parallel, sum up, do a partial reduction of each chunk into a separate reduction variable, and I'm going to, after I'm done with that, I'm going to sum up those partial results, and because addition is associative, which was actually a premise for our being able to do a parallel reduction in the first place, I can do that very easily. And now I have four additions in serial afterwards, and that's really, really quick. I don't even have to think about the cost of that. So when I run this, I actually am very disappointed. It's not faster. It's just marginally faster or sometimes even slower than the original. And I'll show you what the graph for that looks like. So I'm not seeing that stage thing that I saw before, right? So I'm actually getting some parallelism here, but look at all that yellow. I'm not being very efficient. The actual computation is in the early two-thirds of this graph here, right? So it's over here. These three threads are doing the computation of four chunks. Right? There's a whole lot of yellow there. Where's that coming from? Well, it's not one of those obvious patterns, right? But it's telling us that something is perhaps not exactly what it should be. And what's going on is that, yes, we don't have to protect these accumulator variables. They are separate, so we don't have a data race here. But what we have is we have a really poor cache behavior. Because what happens here is that those four sum accumulator variables, they happen to live on the same cache line. Because cache lines are bigger than register sizes or word sizes. So in fact, we could have as many as 32-bit integers on a single cache line on a 128-byte cache line. On a big cache line, we could have lots of them. And so so what happens is that as I write to my four sums, the chip has to keep those cache lines across processors coherent so that all of them have the same view. So it's adding a whole lot of cache coherence traffic to the processing, which is bad. So now I don't actually know what size cache line I have here, but what I did was as a third version, and by the way, this effect is called false sharing. It's like things that aren't really shared data happen to be shared by physical arrangement in the memory layout. So I don't actually have any idea what size my cache line is here, but I'll just say, let's assume that it's 128 bytes. That's a pretty big cache line. But I'll just be very conservative. And what I do is I'll fill my cache line with one integer and then a whole bunch of padding. Okay. And then I have another version of this. Where instead of using int as the type of my sum array of accumulator variables, I use the cache line there, and then I use only the data portion. So I'm wasting a lot of space here, but I'm doing it for a good reason. And so I actually sum up in there, but I have spaced the variables apart by at least a cache line. And if I look at the result of that, I still see some yellow. That's kind of disappointing, but I see a whole lot more green, right? And in fact, it's a little bit misleading because the time scale here is different than in the previous graph. So if we had used the same time scale, this would be very much shorter, and the yellow lines would be very, very thin. But I've achieved something that looks a whole lot better. The green stuff is all in parallel. I'm getting real parallel execution of my code, and I can see it here, right? So this is the kind of things that the parallel profiler can be used for. And again, it's very visual. It's really leveraging what kind of establishing a partnership between what the profiler can do to, and computers are really, really good at, which is collect massive amounts of data and present it, and what the human brain is really, really efficient and good at, which is analyzing visual patterns. And the gallery is readily available under this hints tab in the window. You just click here and you get to the gallery. I have it already here. There's about four or five patterns that are shown here. We have uneven work distribution. Uneven work distribution is when you didn't parallelize enough. So you're actually towards the tail end of an execution. Some things are continued to go, but other things are done, and now you don't have anything to fill behind with. And that leads to these two patterns. It looks like a staircase here, right? Oversubscription, you did too much parallelization. So now you're making the system create more worker threads than processors, and they continue to work, and they can keep interrupting each other. That's never good. You're adding overhead that doesn't actually do anything. Inefficient I/O, reading 4 bytes from a file at a time, maybe not what you want to do. Try to block it up a little bit. There are other reasons for inefficiency, of course, than that, but try to read big chunks of I/O of disk and network. Lock convoys. Lock convoys is what happens when you have fair locks. Fair locks try to say, oh, this lock is already taken, but I'm going to remember you, and I'm going to give, when the lock becomes available, I'm going to give it in the order that you came in. It's kind of like when you call up a customer service phone number, you get serviced in the order that you came in, but everybody's busy. Well, that's not necessarily a good thing when it comes to mutual exclusion locks, because the thing that has waited the longest is the thing that is least likely to have data in cache. It's the thing that is, has to be swapped in from disk and so on and so forth, perhaps even. And the thing that unfair locks do, like spin locks, for example, is that whoever randomly happens to be executing at the point when the lock becomes available gets the lock, and that can often be more efficient, even if it doesn't necessarily feel very fair. Unfair locks can cause starvation, so you have to be able to fall back on a more fair structure if you're seeing that in the application. But fair locks are not necessarily all that good either. All right. So I'm on the very tail end of my presentation here. Just give a couple of performance tips. Only parallelize when you have lots of computation and or lots of data. We saw I had to actually put 20 million integers into that array, into that vector, for addition to be interesting. For more costly operations than integer addition, which is about as cheap as it gets on a circuit, you may have to do fewer than 20 million, right? But you have to have significant work or significant data to do it. Otherwise, it's just you're better spending your time on something else. Use the concurrency profiler, of course, the debugger also, but use the concurrency profiler to understand your parallel code. Even if you don't feel that it's failing your expectations, it may be that it could be surpassing your expectations, and you're leaving that on the table, so to speak. You don't want to do that. Parallelize fine-grained. Fine-grained avoids that sort of imbalance in the system, but be careful to not go too fine-grained. And this is something we didn't talk much about, which is to prefer immutable data structures, prefer isolated data over having to synchronize access to data. This is where functional languages are really good. But there are things that you can do on your own to try to promote the use of immutable data types whenever you can. Synchronization is the enemy of scalability. It was true 20 years ago, it's true today, and it will be true in the future. And MSDN is really the hub for all Microsoft platform technologies and information about it. That goes for the parallel technologies as well. We have everything is reachable through this msdn.com/concurrency start page, if you will. And from there, there's just a wealth of information on what's in Visual Studio 2010. And I encourage you to take a serious look at that. Thank you so much.